This is the Washington Indivisible Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Cox. Hey, everybody. So we have something really special for you this week. It is our first ever live town hall. It is with none other than Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson, who is, of course, running to be our next governor. This was done in partnership with the wonderful people at Indivisible Tacoma. So my deep gratitude to everybody there. So without further ado, here is our discussion with Bob Ferguson, which was recorded on Sunday, March 17th.
So listen, I will confess that as I was preparing for this, I start a little bit in quite a place to dig in because you've accomplished so much as Attorney General. I do want to start with what we know is going to be a key issue in this year's election, that's abortion rights. And of course, you've done so much on this. You ensured the legal right to MIPA Prestone here at the state. You supported and pushed through the My Health, My Data Act. Yes. As governor, what more can be done to ensure a woman's right to choose here in the state?
Yeah, thanks for that. First, thanks everybody for turning out on the most beautiful day of the year so far. Thanks for doing that. Number two, if I stand up, do I mess up whatever camera's going off? I stand up. Okay, cool. I've been sitting. We've been on a road trip from Aberdeen down the coast to South Bend and down to Long Beach and then through Catlamet to Klamath and up the highway. So in the last 48 hours, so I'm going to stand because I've been sitting a lot. That's okay. And I'll try and keep my answers relatively short because and I know you probably have a lot of them. But what I'll say is that your question's a really good important one because in this race for governor, Dave Riker, my likely opponent in November, is anti-choice, right? Seattle Times calls him an anti-choice stalwart. And what he says on the campaign trail is, oh, don't worry about me being anti-choice voters. I'm not going to get in the way of that, right? Well, look, first, I think we've learned our lesson on that, okay, right? Number two, to your question directly, even though Washington is a pro-choice state, thanks to the voters, through the initiative process, right, that enshrined that, the reality is we see threats to reproductive freedom that come even to Washington State in a post-Dobbs landscape. I'll just give you the one example. You alluded to it, the Mifepristone case. Mifepristone, the abortion medication used in more than half abortions in Washington State and across the country. As you know, an anti-abortion group filed a lawsuit in Texas in a very specific court where they knew they would get a judge appointed by Donald Trump, and they asked that judge to issue a nationwide ban on access to Mifepristone. I'll spare you the details, but that judge issued that national order, okay, which would have included Washington State. Two things. One, we filed our own lawsuit in Washington State. Once we saw what was happening, that was successful here in Washington to maintain access, right, to counteract that ruling. That's number one. And number two, while we were doing that, we're obviously talking to Governor Inslee about what's going on. And there's no slam dunk we're going to win that case, of course. So we had a governor, thankfully, at that time, who realized, hey, just in case this lawsuit doesn't work, maybe I as governor should be doing something to make sure we have access to Mifepristone. So he worked as the governor to purchase, it was like 3 years worth of Mifepristone. I forget the exact amount, but it was a lot, right? 3 years worth of Mifepristone as a backstop in case our lawsuit was not successful and in case Mifepristone really was not allowed to be accessible here in Washington State. So that's just one example of how having a governor who's vigilant on defending your reproductive rights is really important.
Yeah, I absolutely, you know, elections matter, as they say. And I hate to even go here, but should things go the way we don't want them to go in November, should we see something like, and this really speaks to how we can protect ourselves here in Washington State against a Trump administration, a Republican Congress, if we were to see a national abortion ban, what, if anything, could we do in response as a state?
So if that were to happen, sort of that disaster scenario, a couple things. So number one, you'll have a different attorney general, right? So choose your attorney general well. Okay, let's start with that. Because if there is a national ban like that, Washington State can, and I suspect would, want to be a leader in litigation that challenges that, right? That is the path in our society, right? Congress takes an action that we disagree with, or a president does an executive action. Hey, we filed 99 lawsuits against the Trump administration during those 4 years, right? So we won all but just a couple of those cases. So that is our avenue, right? If something draconian, and that's not even the word for it, but if something draconian, extreme, happens along those lines. So I think as a governor, you know, fortunately I have some experience, right, being an attorney general on how to push back on those types of things. But there would no doubt be folks looking at potential litigation to challenge that. And I should add, just one more thing I'll add to that is, you know, that Dobbs decision terrible decision, taking away constitutional rights for the first time from Americans, right? Of course, what the Supreme Court said was, let's leave it to the states, right? Let's leave it to the states. Well, if Congress is now acting to sort of strip it away nationwide, an argument would be, hey, wait a second, states should have the right to protect access to reproductive freedom if they so choose.
So it's related to that, and Kat alluded to this in your introduction. January marked the 7-year anniversary of Trump's Muslim ban, which you famously fought back against and won. A round of applause for that.
Thanks, yeah.
I think you have the best record of anybody going up against the Trump administration. What was your final score?
It's pretty good. I never mind that question, by the way. We encourage it. So we had 99 lawsuits. I think 58 of them ended up being decided in the courts. Some other cases didn't get resolved for any number of reasons. They withdrew the action. Another court decided somewhere else. But the 58, I think, that got decided, we won 55 and lost 3. I'm pretty sure was our record. So not too bad. Not that bad.
So once again, I'll just go here one last time, because I really wanted to ask your thoughts on what might potentially happen. We know that immigrants will be under fire under a Trump administration. What could be done to protect people living in Washington who may come under threat?
If there's a Trump administration?
If there's a Trump administration.
So a couple thoughts. So number one, I've been saying for about a year, I think it's 50-50 that Donald Trump gets elected president. And nothing that's happened last year has changed my feelings about that. So that's number one. As dark as that is, it's just what I think is reality, and we all need to prepare and do everything we can, obviously. If that dark day comes, or he's president again, you know, what I would say is, as a state, as dark as that is, what I would say is Washington State is far better prepared to push back against his agenda than we were in January of 2017 when he first took office. Why is that? First, you know, we have 4 years of experience in Washington State of litigating against him successfully, right? So when we started that Muslim travel ban, look, we thought that was a one case and maybe there'd be one or two others, that's it. The idea that we would have filed 99, if you told me that weekend we're working on the Muslim travel ban, that there'd be 98 more lawsuits against the Trump administration, I would say, that's crazy. We can't possibly litigate that amount. We don't have the personnel and the team, there's no way. So a lot of that was sort of building the plane as we were flying it during those 4 years to get the resources and the hiring and the expertise to do that work. So the good news is Colleen Milligan, she's head of my civil rights division. She still is head of my civil rights division. She was there for all 4 years of the Trump administration. She helped lead the team on the Muslim travel ban. Trust me when I tell you this, Colleen Melody, who finished first in her class at the University of Washington Law School, will know how to deal with Donald Trump, okay? She's there, and that team has grown dramatically since the first day of that Muslim travel ban. So whoever the new attorney general is going to inherit a team far larger and apparently more sophisticated just because we have all those years of experience in the federal courts. I think that'll help. Number two, I think, I'll try and keep it relatively brief, but number two, one thing that I think will help is the courts obviously were a bulwark against Donald Trump, right? We are successful, other AGs were successful. And it was my experience or feeling during those 4 years that federal judges at some point during that process became very skeptical of what the Trump administration was saying about different executive actions. You know, first Muslim travel ban, a good example. Like literally they said, federal courts cannot review the reasoning behind that Muslim travel ban to see if there was a racial animus when it was executed. Well, that's a breathtaking description of presidential authority that federal courts can't even examine why a president might have made a decision. So I think that 4 years of courts ruling against him, I think will help if we have to go back to those federal courts again. I think they're just gonna be skeptical because of, for good reason, right? The Trump administration was playing fast and loose with the facts through a lot of federal litigation. Guess what, federal judges don't like that. When you walk in court and you play fast and loose with the facts. So, there'd be other reasons for some, I don't want to say optimism, that's not the right word, but what I would say is as a state, we are far, far better prepared for that litigation aspect of it, the team being in place and having that expertise, than we were in January 2017 by a long shot.
Yeah, I think Washington is a great place to be for a host of reasons,
yes.
And certainly having you as governor
thanks.
As a bulwark against that would be absolutely essential.
I never would have thought that I was qualified to to know how to push back against the president threatening our democracy. They don't teach a class of that in law school, by the way. But I feel like I'm as qualified for that job as anybody in the country. Yeah, that's true.
So something else that's under threats consistently is the climate.
Yeah.
We have a lot of audience questions about this. I want to get your thoughts first on Initiative 2017. So this is the Republican-backed ballot initiative that would repeal the state's carbon market under the Climate Commitment Act. Right. We know that the Cap and Invest program has done a ton of good. It raised $1.8 billion last year for investment into climate programs. So talk first about the importance of the Climate Commitment Act, but then also how you think we defeat this measure, what ways we can message to beat this thing back.
I guess I've got a couple of thoughts on that. I mean, obviously I'm running my campaign, right? And there'd be a whole campaign around that, right, obviously. And so a lot of folks who are organized around that campaign specifically and encouraging involvement, that's an issue you care a lot about, and I suspect you do. So I guess a couple things, though, I would say just, obviously have some thoughts about it. I mean, you touched on a key part, which is number one, the amount of dollars being invested as a result of that act to help move us to a green economy, for clean air, for clean water, for all things that we care about, right? That is going to be a huge resource. That said, I think it's important to acknowledge, hey, any law, when it's adopted, can always be improved. And there's no question the Climate Commitment Act can be improved as well, right? There are things that can be done to help farmers, for example, and others, right, for the costs that are sometimes being borne there to make sure we're addressing that. So refining that law is important, and frankly, I think people expect that of elected officials, right? You pass a good law, but you're always looking at it, you're always scrutinizing. How can we improve this? Was there an unintended consequence for a certain group of folks in our community that we didn't anticipate? What can we do to resolve that? So my view is, hey, tweak it as necessary to improve it, but don't throw out the whole thing. That makes no dang sense, right, with the climate crisis that we're facing. So obviously, I support the Climate Commitment Act and oppose the initiative. In terms of the campaign tactics or strategy, I won't spend a ton of time on that because others will be more experts, but what I will say is that initiative will be one of national consequence. In other words, that other states will be looking at what happens in Washington State on the future of the Climate Commitment Act. And I'm confident that if it gets defeated or if the initiative passes, you know what I'm saying, if the Climate Commitment Act is struck down, that for other states, they may be reluctant to go a similar course because, hey, if it got struck down in Washington by the people, maybe we're not going to invest the energy to pass something similar. So I think it's important to improve our laws where that needs to be done, but obviously defend all the good that's in the Climate Commitment Act, and obviously I support doing that.
Yeah, and talking about the Climate Commitment Act, you know, you're sort of touching around the edges of this, but jumps in the climate often seem to be in tension, right? Certainly in logging, but in other sectors, energy, agriculture, things like that. Do you see a way that the interests of both the climate and jobs can be served?
Oh, man. I'm so glad you asked that, being in a labor hall, by the way. So, I mean, we don't have time to go into details of this, but the short answer is yes, okay, right? And that's what makes sort of this transition to a green economy, I think, so exciting for the state of Washington. So, by the way, our governor has done a fantastic job on leading on this. Our legislature has done a good job. And so, but the blueprint is there, right? Moving to being carbon neutral in the coming years, right? And transition that green economy. That's not just good for our air. That's not just good for our water. That's not just good for climate. But to your question, it is good for jobs, right? And in many, many, many conversations I've had with our labor friends, including in this very room, they're excited about that. A couple things I would say. They want to make sure they have a seat at the table for those decisions because they bring expertise, but absolutely under my administration, they'll have that seat at the table. And that is a real opportunity to bring together growth of jobs, right? Business opportunities all around the state of Washington and doing right by our air and our water and our climate all at the same time. So I see this as an example of bringing together lots of different groups with a similar objective to make that happen. Look, there will be challenges. We don't have time to get into sort of the siting, the permitting, all that goes into that. Moving that green economy will be a big challenge all around the state of Washington. But to your point, it's great for jobs and great for our climate.
You know, you mentioned Governor Inslee's focus on the climate. Do you plan to have a signature focus as governor in the same way that he has in climate?
I guess I'd say a couple things on that. So number one, I think, may I ask that two ways. So number one, if you're an attorney general or if you're a governor, you have to juggle many things, right? You know, as attorney general, obviously during the Trump years, okay, we had a big focus around Trump litigation naturally, but obviously we're doing all sorts of other work on behalf of the people, consumer protection work and other civil rights work. You have to juggle many, many things that are going on at the same time, giving good advice to our clients. As a governor, a top priority right from the gate is public safety issues that are facing our state. So I just came from a swing, I think I mentioned, from Aberdeen on down the coast. It doesn't matter where I go around the state, I've been to all 39 counties, I'm on a second tour of all 39 counties, right? We just keep going back to talk to folks. And look, we all deserve a safe place to live and to work and to play. We deserve that. And you know, when it comes to public safety issues, that's a priority of mine. As Attorney General, we have a criminal division. We handle cases related to sexually violent predators, the individuals who are sent to Neal Island. Most of those folks are sent there by the team in my office. We have a criminal justice division that helps local prosecutors all around the state with cases that they can't handle for any number of reasons. So public safety is very important to me. It's important to the public. And making sure we're addressing issues like, hey, right now, Washington State ranks last per capita. We rank last per capita in number of law enforcement officers. Look, that's not okay. We need to improve that. And there are things that governor can do to help in that respect. So that'd be a top priority for me right from the get-go.
Well, you alluded to that, and I know that you look at the data. Washington State's violent crime level has risen pretty substantially over the last few years. We were historically around 20 to 25% below the national average. We've risen to just under 1% within the last couple of years. We're still well below the peak levels of the 1990s, but I'm wondering what you make of that and some of the ways you would like to address that.
Well, there are a lot of reasons for increasing crime. I mean, obviously COVID had a huge impact, right? You look at downtown, I live in Seattle, downtown Seattle, fewer people on the streets of downtown Seattle, right? Including for those years, people in my office, right? Fewer eyes on the streets, all of that has an impact. So I think there are many reasons for it. I think what I'm focused on moving forward is how to best to address that, right? So as a governor, for example, you have control over the budget process. Control being strong. You propose a budget, you work with the legislature to adopt a budget. So for our state patrol, we can work to make sure we increase, right, the number of folks serving the state in the state patrol. With local jurisdictions, we have local elected officials here, of course. They control their hiring for their local law enforcement. But hey, guess what? As a former county council member, I know their budgets are strapped. They've got competing needs. A state can be helpful in this regard by doing what I'm proposing, what a few governors have done around the country, is create a fund that is available for local jurisdictions to utilize when hiring law enforcement officers. For example, it could be a bonus to attract people to come to your jurisdiction, to the city of Tacoma, or whatever jurisdiction it might be. You can draw from that fund to attract folks to your jurisdiction to serve and help keep our public safe. So there are a number of things that a governor can do working with local jurisdictions and with law enforcement and the state as well.
There's a little bit of a push and pull with this as well. We had an audience question that basically talked about how we've seen a lot of progressive rollback in terms of, you know, we certainly just saw in the legislature rollback on police chase legislation, Oregon has rollback drug legislation, San Francisco has expanded policing surveillance, drug testing for social services. And that just kind of begs a larger question from a policy standpoint, how do we balance concerns about public safety with a need to prevent potential harm to impact the communities?
Oh, I think that's, look, I mean, my approach as governor would be no different than as attorney general. I mentioned a few minutes ago, we do a lot of work at my office with law enforcement all across the state. So I think I mentioned our criminal division, and just to elaborate just for a minute how that works. So if someone, and I hope this doesn't happen, but if someone broke into your car while we're in this meeting, my office does not have the authority to prosecute that case. That authority rests with your local county prosecutor. Okay, the 39 county prosecutors have, that is their jurisdiction. City attorneys have some control as well on misdemeanors. We have a criminal division though, because if, for example, a key witness to that break-in was a county employee in the prosecutor's office, they may not be able to bring the case because they're conflicted because of a conflict. Or if it's a smaller jurisdiction, it's a murder, for example, they may have the resources for a very lengthy, labor-intensive murder trial. They can then turn to my office and say, hey, Ferguson, will you take this case for us? They can essentially grant me the jurisdiction and my team to bring those cases. And so that's what we do in our office. So we work closely, of course, with law enforcement all across the state. And one can do that and be mindful about, hey, how can we do things that improve public safety as well? I support body cameras on all law enforcement officers, right? When they're out there doing important work and serving the public, to have greater transparency, right, when it comes to public safety. I think that's important. So I think you can do both those things. These are not false choices, right, of doing both things. One can do both. We do certainly do that in my office, and we continue to do that as a governor as well.
We should talk about housing. Of course, lack of affordable housing impacts every corner of the state, as we know, and the homelessness crisis related to this. You say, as governor, that you want to start a cabinet-level housing department.
Yep.
Talk a little bit about
this. You've been reading our plan. That's good. He's on our plan. He's working it. That's good.
All right. I try to do my research.
That's right.
But so, yeah, you're talking about instituting this this cabinet-level department. Talk a little bit about the state of the crisis that we're facing right now, and really why you feel it's been so intractable, and then talk about a little bit of what this cabinet-level department will bring to the table. That's new.
Okay, multi-part question. If I forget some of those, let me know, but I think I'll track most of it. So I'll take a few minutes on this, because this is a big issue, if that's okay. So first, just to put the scale of, I think you referred to crisis or the real challenges we have, just to put some number around this, which I think is always helpful, is in Washington State, we need to build 1 million new units of housing of all types, in the next 15 to 20 years, just to put a number on that. Okay, so you do the math on how much each year, how much construction that is, all across our state. Number two, having been to all 39 counties, I'm often asked, hey, what did you most hear when you've been to all 39 counties? And that answer is easy. What I heard the most in traveling to every corner of the state was this issue, affordable housing. It's from affordability generally, but specifically around housing. And this is felt in communities all across the state. And so, you mentioned a proposal I have to housing is currently right now under our Commerce Department. I'll spare you the details of the intricacies of state government, but it's under Commerce. Commerce is massive, okay, massive, massive. What I propose to do is take housing, which is plenty big on its own, take it out of Commerce and make it a cabinet level agency. That's what you're mentioning. The reason for that, there's a lot of reasons, but in a nutshell, it's been my experience as Attorney General that we have, at any moment in time, we've got 20,000 legal matters going on. We have 800 lawyers in my office, okay? There's a lot going on at any moment in time. Obviously, of those thousands of legal matters, what I actually can know about, right, is limited for obvious reasons, right? So a key part of my job I've learned as leader of the office is to communicate very clearly to the team which cases I want to know about, and I'm getting a direct report from my team I meet with every single day. I've got a team I meet with every day, and I make sure that they know, okay, these cases, I need to know in real time what's going on, right? In a sense, it's like my cabinet level agency, right, and folks who are important to me. So I've really learned that what I communicate down and what's important to me helps with what comes back to me to make decisions and stay on top of things. When it comes to housing, we have a crisis right now. And my feeling is I want to communicate to my team and the people of the state by extension that I understand that this is a big challenge, and I don't want this in Commerce, I want this at a cabinet level, so I know I'm getting that level of direct feedback from a cabinet level agency on something that's important. That communicates down to the team, and communicates that, hey, this is urgent, this is a crisis, Bob, the governor really, really cares about this, we need to make sure we're doing everything we can to address that. So those would be the key things. A couple of things I'll add to that is, and this may be, I'll let you follow up. You look like you're about to jump on that.
I was going to ask, in terms of the cabinet itself, are you appointing from within? Are you appointing community activists, thought leaders? Who would be part of this cabinet?
Oh, I mean, look, I've got to get elected first, right? I guess what I would say, I appreciate the optimism there. What I would say about hiring in general, this is just a general observation about hiring that I'll share, is that, how do I want to say it? I think my team would agree with this, is that when I make hiring decisions in my office, when I'm hiring, it's like for the folks who are the Solicitor General, the first Assistant Attorney General, the Chief Deputy, the top folks in the office, right, or the folks that I get involved in the hiring. And when I make those decisions, obviously the folks have to have a certain level of experience, right? But I've never been someone where I feel like someone has to check each and every certain number of boxes to get a key job. So I'll give you one example. When I became Attorney General, Solicitor General is a huge job in our office. This is the person who I think is like the top lawyer in the office, the person who handles all of our appeals. If there's a state Supreme Court case, they're all often arguing it themselves. If there's a U.S. Supreme Court, they're often arguing that. Big, big job in our office, overseeing all of our appeals. That was vacant when I became Attorney General. Lots of qualified folks within the office who argued the Supreme Court many, many, many times wanted that job. It's a big job. I hired someone from outside the office, a guy named Noah Purcell. I think at the time, Noah might have been 31 years old. I think he was the youngest Solicitor General in the country when I hired him. The challenge was he looks 10 years younger than that, so he looked 21. But Noah had never once argued a case before the state Supreme Court. He never once argued a case before the U.S. Supreme Court. He was an associate of law firm. Now, Noah is an extraordinarily gifted attorney, okay? He gone. So I'm the top law school in the country. So I'm a law review, clerk of the U.S. Supreme Court. He's an extraordinary talent, and I knew that about him. Now, did he check every box that you would typically have for that job? Definitely not. And in hiring him, was there some controversy in the office around that? Yeah. You know, there were people there like, hey, wait a second, I've actually argued this in Supreme Court 20 times, and this guy has never done it once. He doesn't know what the job is. Well, look, nobody now questions that decision. Like, Noah is beloved in our office. He does extraordinary work on behalf of people. And what I wanted in that job was someone who was the best possible lawyer that I could hire, with the best possible writing ability, and who also did not act like the smartest person in the room, even if he was the smartest person in the room, which Noah is, right? And he was someone that we could all work with. And that is 110% Noah Purcell. And so that's just my philosophy, right? I want folks who are sort of committed to my vision. Thanks. And so that's just been my approach. I want people who are sort of committed to share the vision I have for what we're trying to do and will challenge me on my ideas, right? But just raise the game, right? Raise the level of the office. That's what's critical, right? Especially for an office like the AG's office. You've been around a zillion years. You've got to evolve and improve and evolve and improve. And often I hire from within. But in that case, I felt that was the right decision, and that's just the way I've always kind of approached the hiring decision.
So I want to ask you next about gun safety, because this is an area where your office is undefeated against the gun lobby. So we saw...
I don't think I heard that. Could you repeat that?
I heard that your office is undefeated against the gun lobby. So we saw three court challenges to the assault weapons ban, all of which were blocked.
Yep.
Talk a little bit about what's your assessment generally on where we're at with gun safety in the state right now, and really, and this is a big question, what more do you think is possible given the headwinds that we face on this issue?
Yeah, so I mean, Washington, as you all know, has come a long way in just the last 2 to 3 years on adopting what I consider common sense public safety measures, like banning the sale of assault weapons and banning the sale of high capacity magazines, both of which happened in the last 2 years, and I was proud to propose those to the legislature. Also passed a bill last year holding gun manufacturers and business accountable if they negligently allow someone who should not have a firearm, who's not allowed to have a firearm, if they act negligently, you got to be accountable. It's like you're accountable if you act negligently with your business or what you do in your driving, right? That's the way the law works. There shouldn't be an exception there. So to your point, each time those bills have been adopted by the legislature, or by the people, I should say, by the initiative process as well, there's always a lawsuit challenging them. Literally always a lawsuit challenging them. For example, the bill about the liability. We were just in federal court in the Eastern District of Washington in the last week or so and won a decision there, for example, defending that. So we have won every case so far. I will just say, maybe focus on the legal side a little bit. You know, we have the U.S. Supreme Court that we have right now, and there are certain challenges there with that court, as you can imagine. And they've adopted some decisions related to, not directly related to, assault weapons, but related to what I would consider common sense gun safety laws in other states. And the reasoning behind those decisions that they articulate can have an impact on legal cases like challenging a assault weapons ban or a high capacity ban. We feel confident, you know, our legal team is excellent in my office. Those folks really know what they're doing, to put it mildly. And so we feel confident we're gonna be able to successfully defend those throughout the appeals that are coming. And so I think for Washington State, we've gone from really not being a leader on having those kinds of laws in place to now in the last couple of years being a leader, to your question, right? And so from my standpoint, sort of proposing laws, those three laws were all laws I had proposed, and also proposed a law a few years ago around ghost guns, which has become a huge problem that we got adopted. So sort of the agenda that I had of those four laws have now all been signed into law. So look, I'm not suggesting there are other things that can be improved, but from my standpoint, that those were the four main bills that we focused on as Attorney General, and we got mandate of all of those passed, and so far we've successfully defended them.
Okay. Yeah. We've got 10 minutes now for some audience questions.
Okay.
I told you we're going to have you done by quarter till, and that's my words. So
we're going
to do this. Okay, so let's begin with a question about hate groups. Papa Townsend of Snohomish says, I'm very worried about the rise of white nationalism and hate groups. Christine Conan also concerned about the rise of hate speech and threats of violence at school board meetings. What more can be done on these related issues?
Yeah, I'd say, so we'll consider this the lightning round, so I'll go quick so we'll get through as many as possible. So, and I'll be around afterwards, happy to chat. Feel free to reach out if you want to chat more. Look, on a lot of those issues, right, the authority to prosecute crimes like that, again, that's your local prosecutor. right? And so making sure I would articulate whoever's asking those questions, talk to your local prosecutor about those. If there is a situation, talk to your local prosecutor. If your local prosecutor says, hey, you know what? Yeah, we understand that happened. We don't have the resources. Say, hey, can you talk to the AG's office? Would they be willing to take it? Do they have the resources, right? There are other options as well. So we take this very seriously, right, these types of crimes. So my team's bandwidth is relatively small, but we are certainly open to taking those cases from local prosecutors if they lack the bandwidth. So I think there are things that we can do. The last thing I would say is, as governor, you know, I'd be interested in taking a look at putting together resources to create units. It could be in the AG's office, for example, that specifically take on those cases. Look, your local prosecutor is busy. They've got a zillion things going on, as you can imagine, right? And so it's not always easy to take on new cases of any kind. So one thing we've done successfully is, for example, the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women, huge crisis in our state. We worked with tribal members to address this issue. We went to the legislature and asked for funding for a unit in my office that can try and solve those cold cases. That can work to solve those cold cases, bring accountability for whoever caused the harm, and some form of closure for the family. So that's an example where you can actually go to legislature for a very specific type of work, right? It'd be related similar for hate crimes. Hey, this is the type of work we're doing. That's what this team does. Then prosecutors know that they can turn to our office for those cases.
Amelia Escobedo asks, what are you currently doing to work for the Chicano, Latino, Indigenous, Mexican, and Hispanic communities?
Yeah, proud that our campaign is broad and diverse, and we've been all around the state talking to communities all across our state, from the International District in downtown Seattle, recently in the Tri-Cities, where we met with folks from Hispanic, Latino community, the farm workers there. Spent a whole day out there meeting with folks. And so what I would say to, and sorry, what's that question?
That was Amelia Escobedo.
Amelia. So if I say Amelia is, that's been, if I just take a minute on this one.
Sure.
So that's been an example of a big change in the AG's office. When I started as Attorney General, we had no civil rights team. So that calling Melody individual I mentioned earlier, right, now the head of my civil rights team. When I became Attorney General in 2013, if you called our office with a civil rights complaint, if you're a farm worker and said, hey, I'm being mistreated on the job here in Central Washington, we referred you somewhere else. Our team had not done affirmative work, civil rights work on behalf of people in many, many decades. But that made no sense to me, right? We should be standing up for all Washingtonians, including the folks, right, that she's referring to. So we created a civil rights division in our office, which is now quite large, headed up by Colleen, who I referenced earlier, who do all sorts of cases. As an example, they had many cases on behalf of farm workers, but a recent one resulted in the business in Central Washington having to change all their corporate practices, pay the state of Washington $3 million for their treatment of mostly women farm workers who were mistreated and often lost their jobs. We took that $3 million and gave every dime of it to those farm workers. So as I'm the only candidate race for governor who does not accept money from large corporations or corporate a lot of reasons for that, but a key one goes to this question, right? That I view my job as standing up for all Washingtonians, right? Wherever you are, that's my job. And look, large corporations, nothing against them, right? But they don't need, right? They have their perspective on every piece of legislation that goes through the halls of Olympia. They have it. Trust me on it. They've got their lobbyists. More power to them. But what I think the whole point of being an attorney general or a governor is you are the voice for the people. Right, you've got a lot of things to keep in mind, but that's foremost on your mind, and as a governor, that'd be my approach as well.
A couple minutes left. Kurtz asks, how can more money be directed to mental health services in Washington State?
Okay, I'm not sure this is a lightning round answer, but I tell my apologies. There's so much to be said on this. Maybe I'll take the last few minutes on this one, just because this is a big one. Couple things I would say to start with. So the issue of mental health has, I don't want to say I've been surprised how frequently it comes up. That would not be right on the campaign trail. But the frequency in which it comes up in all sorts of different contexts has struck me. Let me just say that. So as one example, talk to educators all across the state. Okay, had many, many meetings. Whenever I ask them, I often start a conversation with someone I'm meeting with, hey, what are your big challenges with the work that you do? Whatever that is, right? Your electrical work, what's your big challenge? For the educators, what's your big challenge? The top three things they mention, mental health, mental health, mental health. I'm not exaggerating, right? That is what they say, right? And so that's just one example, right, of many that go to this question. Mental health is a huge issue in our state, as you all know. I appreciate the fact that sort of the stigma of talking about it is lessening, I think, a little bit as more and more people speak about it. I've gotten a little more comfortable talking about it. We had a family member who committed suicide a number of years ago. It was a total shock to our family, I can assure you. This was an individual who had, by all accounts, a successful life, you know, served in World War II, successful, who was an older adult, family, committed to going to a park and shot himself. No. It was a total shock to our family. And so we know how pervasive this is. So when I was on the King County Council and I started in politics, you know, I was sort of picking issues that I felt I had some personal connection to get involved in. Mental health was a big one. And I got very involved in passing at the King County Council a mental health and temporary dependency sales tax. Counties have the authority to do that, where the funds can only go to addressing mental health or chemical dependency issues. So this is an issue that's important to me. So to the question is, what we need, right, are additional resources that go to help folks with the treatment they need, right, to address the really significant challenges that they have. The one thing I hear over and over again is folks who say, hey, I've got a kid who's got this situation, but they take so long to get in to get the help that they need. What can we do as a state? So as a governor, that budget is a document that reflects the values of our state. I know we're investing in mental health, but we need to invest more, right? Because the need is so great from our schools to folks all across our communities. That's an issue I care a great deal about personally and would be a priority as a governor.
We are at Porter Field. The floor is yours for your final thoughts.
Oh, hey, first, thanks again for coming out on a packed room, by the way, on a beautiful, beautiful day. I always worry on a really beautiful day like this, like, is anybody really going to come in here? And but it's great to see you all. And maybe the thing I just will mention is that, I've not talked much about, Dave Reichert, other than maybe the first question, right, that we talked
about. We have some people here who are familiar.
I'm Dave
Reichert. I'm from the 8th CD.
No, well, I guess what I just will say is that, maybe two things. One, this election will be very close, okay? So I just beg you, do not be complacent about this election. I know it is tempting to think of Washington as a safe blue seat. After all, haven't Democrats been governor for 40 years? After all, isn't every statewide elected official a Democrat? Just being honest with you, I sense a sense of complacency about this race. And I'm here to tell you that it's unfounded. And I'll tell you why. The last two campaigns for governor in Washington State where there was no incumbent like this one. So that does not mean you can't count Jay Inslee running in 2020 against Lauren Pope. Right. Lauren Pope is not a serious man, not a serious candidate for governor. That's why he lost by 500,000 votes. Okay. If you look at the last two open seats, that's Chris Gregoire beating Dino Rossi. By the way, Dino Rossi, an unknown state senator, right, compared to Dave Reichert, who's far more named community, right? Chris Gregoire beating Dino Rossi and Jay Inslee defeating Rob McKenna. Combine those two races, total margin of victory for Chris Gregoire and Jay Inslee. No slouches, by the way, knowing how to campaign. I think we'd all agree these folks know how to campaign. Total margin of victory, 3% points. Chris Gregoire won by 133 votes. In other words, the number of people in this room, if they flipped their vote, it'd be a different outcome, right? Just give you a sense of scale. And Jay Inslee was behind in the polls for months in that race until he pulled ahead at the end and won by a hard-fought campaign by 3 points. Look, I would bet my kid's entire college tuition fund that this race will be decided by 3 points or less. I believe that. That's why we are working so hard, right? We are working so hard, taking nothing for granted. So I really need your help with this. Just get the word out. We have signs here. I believe they are.
Yeah.
We have signs in the back. Good. We have a good answer on that. We have signs in the back. Number two, spread the word. And number three, I just want to say briefly about one thing about Dave Reichert I do want to say is he was in Congress the first 2 years Donald Trump was president. And you've asked about Donald Trump a few times. He was a member of Congress. Think about how badly during those 2 years you'd have loved to have been a member of Congress to tell Donald Trump with your vote and your bully pulpit exactly what you thought about what he was doing to our country. Think about what that would have meant to you, the power to have that job at that moment in our nation's history. Here's what Dave Reichert did with that power that he had. In those 2 years, he voted with Donald Trump's agenda. People track this. He voted with Donald Trump's agenda 93% of the time.
Yeah.
We'd loved. He voted with the Donald Trump agenda more than any member of our congressional delegation, including Kathy McMorris Rogers, Eastern Washington. He voted with Donald Trump's agenda more often than Mitch McConnell. He voted with more often than Ted Cruz. He voted with him more often than Matthew Gaetz, that crazy MAGA congressman, Matthew Gaetz, right? So, I mean, I'm serious, right? That he will be trying to spend the next 8 months telling you he's moderate. He is no moderate. I mean, he is who he is, and fair is fair. I want to make sure every person in Wash State understands what his values actually are and how they... The list can go on, but I really will need you to communicate that to your network, right? To your friends, to your relative who may be a Republican, right? Or an independent, right? Communicate that to those folks, because guess what? Lots of independents and Republicans care about choice, right? Lots of those folks care about healthcare, right? Riker voted to repeal Obamacare repeatedly. He's opposed to marriage equality. The list goes on. You get the idea. So really, we'll be communicating a lot about Dave Riker, we already are, but I ask you to communicate that out to your network as well, because this election will be close. But if we work hard, I'm confident we'll win. Thanks so much for being here.
And that'll do it for this week. The executive producer of the show is Kat Pipkin. If you would like to see a video version of this podcast, head to facebook.com/indivisiblepodcast. The email address for the show is indivisiblepodcast@gmail.com. Special thanks to Lori Colwell, and as always, my thanks to you for listening. I'm Stephen Cox, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.